everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Ringside Chat. I am one third of the co-hosting team, Joe Kasbinski, and joining me tonight is the other third, Court Montgomery. How you doing today?
Pretty good, man. How about you?
Not too bad. Well, we're missing Gary. He left us for the Penguins.
Son of a bitch.
I know. And I got the game. Like I said earlier, I got the game going on in the corner of my computer right now. So if you hear a random mute, it's either me yelling or cussing.
So. I'm following it on my phone too, so I can't say too much.
Yeah, well, you know, Gary's the only one that decides to just, you know, leave us.
And this messes with us about shit.
Exactly.
I may be late due to circumstances sometimes, but at least I'm here for every episode.
That's what I said, you know. But he's left us with, you know, first.
This is twice that he's missed a full episode.
Right, you know, the Penguins, and he had the shit, so. But, so, I'm glad that today's episode is going to be a shoot from the hip, because after last episode, doing all of the notes and research and shit, I'm glad we're taking this one a little easy.
Dude, I mean, between, you know, I know you did a lot of research on that. I did a healthy bit of research for some fucking reason, to the backstories and shit for Halloween Havoc 95, so it'll be nice to just go back to kind of how we started off and just kind of maybe a loose topic or two and just seeing where it goes.
I agree. It's just, yeah. I think we do a lot better, too, with these random topics. Not that, you know, I know this, our past episode did really well, and the Halloween Havoc ones did really well and stuff, so I know that.
Well, part two did. Part one didn't really do shit, and I can't understand why.
Because everybody fell asleep during the Johnny B. Bad match.
Yes.
As soon as they heard us talking about it.
That's right. Shit, I was too, but I had a reason. I was way too intoxicated to be on this fucking thing.
Well, I lasted until, I think, Luger and Ming, and then I fell asleep, so.
I can't remember where, like, when I really watched it. I can't remember where I fell asleep, because I know for a fact I did, because I had to start back over.
Oh, I definitely fell asleep there. As soon as they, I think it was after that match, as soon as they handed Luger the microphone, I was out. So. I mean, he's never, when the man, it's funny, I was listening, or I was watching a promo with Luger, and he can't say accolades, he calls it allocades. So, I knew right from there, like, even in Crockett, I was like, oh, this guy's terrible.
It's so, because, like, I consider myself a Luger fan, but I don't like watching him wrestle. I don't know why I, like, in my head, I'm like, yeah, I like Lex Luger. And I sit down and watch his shit, and I'm like, no, I don't. No, something. The best match he ever had, in my personal opinion, was the Super Brawl 91 match. Him and Sting wrestled the Steiners. And I don't even want to give him, or honestly even Sting, any credit for that match, because it was just the Steiner brothers beating the shit out of them.
I always, and that's the thing, like, I always liked Luger and Flair, or even Windham and Luger, and then you come to realize, well, yeah, Luger's okay, but it was more so Windham and Flair making him look good.
Yeah, it's true. Luger had a good look about him, and his promos were terrible. But, like, he had a really good presence as a heel in the ring. He just seemed like a cocky prick. So I think that's why, like, I liked him so much. Because my favorite Luger is, like, 91, 92 Luger, right before he left the company, had that title run.
Right.
That's when I liked him the most, when he had Harley Race as a manager.
Yeah, I would say I liked probably Luger when him and Windham were teaming up together. And then then Luger turned on him, Windham turned on him, and then he went and joined the Four Horsemen. That's the Luger I like too.
Yeah, between, I would say, between like 88 when he first started teaming with Sting, that's right after Wyndham turned on him, till about probably 92 is like really like my era when I enjoyed Lex Luger. Pretty much when he came to the WWF and after, it just kind of went downhill. I'm not even going to say it was his fault. I just, the type of matches he had from that point on, as opposed to the matches he had in Crockett, just made him a different performer.
Yeah, it's real funny because you would think that, Vince, you know, obviously liked him because of his build and everything like that, but it was like he, you know, Vince tried to make him Hulk Hogan, but that's not the most effective way to use Lex Luger. He's not, you know, he's not going to be Hulk Hogan. He doesn't wrestle those types of matches, but... So, yeah, I won't say that Luger's WWF run's all his fault.
But can we just talk about... Let's talk about that for a second. I feel really bad for Luger. Because have you ever heard the story behind... Okay, so you know in the SummerSlam 93,
mm-hmm.
Luger wins the match by countout, but still he gets all of the treatment like he won the title.
Right.
Apparently that was a last-minute decision by Vince.
Okay.
He felt that Luger winning the title wouldn't have meant as much at SummerSlam as it was going to at WrestleMania. So he decided, I don't know if it was the day of or whatever, because that's the reasoning why they had all the stuff. Luger, the whole time, was supposed to beat Yoko at SummerSlam that year. But Vince made the last-minute decision to draw the program out to give Luger a bigger moment of winning the Rumble and winning it at Mania. And then by the time Rumble rolls around, he realizes how big of a flop Luger is. That's why he does that split with Luger and Brett. Apparently, when Brett and Luger won, he still hadn't even decided who was going to win the belt. Brett or Luger. He was still kind of hoping that Luger, I think I heard this on Pritchard's podcast actually,
yeah,
that so. He was waiting to see, like, maybe Luger's going to catch on, and he just ended up figuring out, hey, Lex is not catching on. We're going to give it to Brett. So it's just a shame that, you know, yeah, we both are in agreement that he wasn't that great in the ring, but, I mean, one of my favorites of all time, the Ultimate Warrior, definitely was not that great in the ring. You know, not saying Luger didn't deserve it. He should have got that WWF title win. I mean, let him have it, and then, you know, they figure out he's a flop, and he could have lost it by, what, Survivor Series? Just, I feel bad for him.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what I liked about Luger was that they put a big emphasis on that, on his forearm with that metal plate in there. And then, you know... That would, to me, would have made it a perfect heel, you know, weapon for him to use. And it's not like he can't use it because, well, it's his body. It's his body part, you know, and stuff. But, yeah, I would have rather them, you know, give him a nice run with it and seen. I mean, Brett Wood is obviously the smarter choice, but, I mean, the guy did deserve it. I mean, they put a lot of you know, equity behind him, so.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a shame. I think another reason why it didn't work is because they pushed him too hard, too fast, and not enough reason for the fans to get behind him as a face. He had already done so much work in that short time as the narcissist. The fans hated him. So I'm thinking maybe that's what it was, is that they didn't really give him a reason to be a babyface. It went from he was a full-fledged heel to... Hey, look, he just body slammed Yokozuna. Let's all love him.
Yeah.
I just don't think it was enough reason for the fans to connect with him. I really think that's what hurt him. Had they given him either a longer run as a heel to get over a little more, or hell, keep that short run as a narcissist, let him come out and make the save for Brett, or, you know, some babyface just to help. Good example. There's an angle, I don't know if you remember. The angle that actually turned Crush heel was where Yoko gives him the big bonsai drop,
mm-hmm.
and the refs are trying to stop him, do all that, and that, you know, he won't stop, and he keeps doing it until Savage comes in, makes the save, and Crush turned heel on Savage because he blamed Savage that he didn't come save him in time, blah, blah, blah. You could have used that to turn Luger. I want to say that was after the fact, but either way, you know, something along those lines. Of Luger comes in to make the save, like he's had enough, and he has that confrontation. just to give the fans a little something to get behind instead of, oh, look, he body slammed him. But remember, he was an asshole for like the past year. You know, I just...
Right. Well, not only that, too, but if you think about it, like, given the time that was, you know, this was all going on, I mean, I know this is... I think, you know, Desert Storm has already, you know, happened and everything. To me, and maybe this is just at hindsight or looking back, I don't think the All-American gimmick at this time is the right thing to do. And I agree, he's been a heel for a year now. Why not run with that or come up with a better idea for a babyface turn for him rather than the All-American thing? Because, you know, we've seen, what, probably, I think it was like six, 9 years later, you know, Kurt Angle comes in and they boo the hell out of him because he's an All-American guy. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think that was the right gimmick for him. Yeah, I agree. Maybe keep him heel or do something different as a babyface. But yeah,
I don't know. I think there's a lot of things you could have done. I think that Vince just really enjoyed that All-American character because, I mean, you had Hogan, who was the epitome of All-American, especially because of, like, the feud with Slaughter when Desert Storm was happening. And I think Vince was too had tunnel vision, and he just wanted that vision for Lex. When you could have let him, I mean, in WCW or in Crockett, he got over as the total package as a babyface. Because of reasons, you know, like, you know, he was a huge heel, he turned on the Horsemen. So the fans instantly got behind him because he turned on the biggest heel faction in the company. So you needed a reason for him to turn babyface instead of just body slamming a heel. Who gives a shit? It should have been a reason for that to happen. And like, and even then, I guess it's just because he's All-American because he just slammed the big foreigner. I think that in 93... the fans were already kind of seeing through the bullshit that was kind of the gimmicks and the catering to the young kids with all the crazy characters and stuff like that. You know, that's, which is why if you looked at WCW around that time, we're doing more realistic type stuff. So I think it was just a bad time, bad place. You know, Luger with a different gimmick could have probably gotten over. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's just that All-American thing. Just people, I think, were just tired of it. Them, hell, they were getting tired of Hogan by that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's funny to think of that, you know, even when Hogan was going into WCW, I mean, there was a little bit of, like, you know, fans being really receptive to it, but then it was, like, within, like, 6 months to a year, that was over. So yeah, the whole American hero thing, it was definitely played out. I mean, you figure too how much they played that up even in the 80s with the Russians and stuff, so it wouldn't make sense that the fans would be tired of it by now.
I mean, in the territorial days, you could get away with things like that because you didn't have these guys that were on your television screen once a week or more often. Coming on to the early 90s when they had multiple television shows a week and getting used to these characters, getting tired of these characters, you could have your evil Japanese guy, your evil Russian guy, or whoever, he'll be gone from the territory in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
So TV, it kind of got, it spoils the audience in a way, and it's overexposure in a way. It's why things have to change so much nowadays, because I mean, no matter how good something is, people get tired of it, good or bad.
Oh, absolutely.
So, another reason, probably. And they pushed, oh God, they pushed that Lex thing down everyone's throat, the goody two-shoes Lex Luger and yada yada. And it's just like, just stop. I get it. He's got a bus. Who gives a shit?
Oh, I didn't see it when it aired, you know, at the time, but I've gone back and seen it. The, I Need a Hero music video or something. Oh, my Lord.
Look, man, that song, You Are My Hero, is like one of my favorite things ever. I remember, I can't remember how long ago it's been, but it was a few WWE games ago that All-American Lex Luger was the DLC.
Okay.
He did not come out to either one of his WWF theme songs. The theme song they gave him in the fucking game was that music video song, that which he never came out to. Me and my buddy used to just crack up about that shit. It was just the most, just the cheesiest, just the most 90s thing you could think of, man.
But I will admit, the one good thing that Luger did have in the WWF, and I was sad it didn't go a little longer, was I liked his tag team with him and Bulldog as the Allied Powers?
Yeah, Allied Powers.
Yeah, I liked that tag team. I thought they worked pretty good for as a you know, big muscle man group.
I agree completely. As a kid, I loved them together. Looking back at it now, though, man, it had to be a big slap in the face for Lex, though, because he went from, I mean, especially, you look at specifically, in a year's time, from WrestleMania 10 to WrestleMania 11, he goes from not being in the main event, but being one of the main event matches, again, in the WWF title match against Yokozuna, to being in the opening match in a tag team at WrestleMania 11. It had to just make him feel like shit, I would think. You know, have all these ideas, all these plans of being the guy, just being bumped down to, you know, curtain jerker.
Right, and I think that's probably why it made it a lot easier for him to, you know, leave in 94?
Yeah, 95.
Yeah, I think that's why it was a lot easier for him to leave in 95, because, yeah, he essentially that's what he is. And they didn't even get a tag title run, I don't think.
No, they sure didn't.
No, so, yeah, so it was basically, he's just there.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever heard the story of how Owen Hart used to fuck with Lex?
No.
All right, so it's been talked about in multiple shoot interviews, but specifically it's been in Owen's DVD, which, again, I highly recommend. So, you know, of course, Davey Boy and Owen would travel together. You know, whatever, they're family. So Luger would travel with them because he's Davey Boy's partner. So they were all friends. But Owen really liked to fuck with Luger because Luger was kind of, I guess, kind of gullible in a way. And he would fall for anything. So Owen would always call a spot where he wanted Lex to give him a press slam. So the spot would be whip Owen hard into the buckle. Lex would go to pick him up to press him. Owen would hook his arm so that Lex couldn't fully extend. And it looked like Lex was struggling him. He could barely lift him up, couldn't even fully get his arms up and slam him. Well, then Lex would immediately tag out to Bulldog. Bulldog would pick Owen Hart and press him straight up with ease, and then continuously press him multiple times before finally slamming him. Mm-hmm. And he would turn around to Lex and flex and goes, "See, Lex, I'm the strongest of the team." And they say Lex would get so mad because Owen would randomly do it, and he would only do it either in front of a big crowd or he did it at least one time on TV. I was like, I think it was an episode of Monday Night Raw. And it's just you know, going, I managed to squeeze in an Owen Hart story here, but it's funny to see stuff like that. But also seeing that, even though he knew it was just in good fun, it was just in good rivings, you know, I can see part of that leading to Lex leaving, getting frustrated. You know, these guys aren't letting me look good. You know, I'm bumped down to opening fucking match. You know, if I was him, I would have been upset too, and probably wanted to leave too if I got an offer somewhere else for the money he got.
Oh yeah, and you talking about that Owen Hart story, it makes me think of the one everybody's heard of, Mr. Perfect ripping all the tassels off of his fucking boots every time that, you know, they do a move, take one off and put it in his tight.
If you pay close attention, and I actually have a screenshot I can send you a link to later, their match at WrestleMania 9 between Luger and Perfect, if you look at the end of the match, Perfect's laid out, and there's a small tassel right beside him.
Oh, man. I remember, though, I read Luger's book, and it's been a while since I read it, but and even I watched him do the kayfabe commentaries on the timeline on WWF. And I think he even admitted that he looks back on it now, and he felt that the Brett was the better guy to go with, even while he was getting his big push. I mean, no guy's going to stop and say, "Hey, I don't want you to push me." But he even knew that going in and listening to the crowd that, you know, this wasn't going to work, that Brett was the guy. And it's just funny that even he thought that compared to what The Office did.
Right, and it could be a situation where hindsight's 20/20, too. You know, you never know with those kind of situations.
Right. So, but... So, I didn't think we'd talk about Lex Luger for damn near a half hour.
Right.
Hey, whatever. Hey, I don't care. So, we'll want to transition into WCW a little bit, because, today, while we're recording, marks Dusty Rhodes' 2-year anniversary of his passing, and... You know, I want to say that as a kid growing up in around the 90s, I didn't know who Dusty Rhodes was. I just knew of the announcer, Dusty Rhodes. And I'm, you know, never understood why they have a guy on WCW television that sounds like he's got a speech impediment. And he's huge. And then people would say, "Well, you know, Goldust is Dusty Rhodes' kid," and I'm thinking, like, really? You know, and then until I had to go back and watch it, did I see the greatness that is the American Dream.
I was a huge Dusty fan, man. Like from childhood, because I grew up, I watched everything. But my main thing that I always enjoyed was the early 90s WWF. So I grew up on Polka Dot Dusty, which a lot of people kind of shit on. But, I mean, even though some people can claim it was a rib, you know, which I think all of us pretty much feel like it was. A lot of people that were in the office around that time swear it wasn't. Either way, if it wasn't, Dusty still went out there and did his Dusty stuff. You know, he was still awesome. And, you know, obviously the type of wrestling that he was doing, his opponents were a lot different. You know, he had more guys that were solid wrestlers, like your Flairs, Arn, Tully, guys like that, and Crockett. Where here, he's like wrestling a lot of guys that aren't as good, I wouldn't say as good wrestlers, but they're more show, which is fine. He had great matches with guys like Boss Man. I mean, he could pull good matches out of Honky Tonk Man. Him and Akeem had good stuff. Him and Savage had great stuff in the early 90s, man, when, you know, good matches were not something WWF was doing. You know, so that's what I grew up on. So me going back and watching serious Dusty in like the late 70s throughout the 80s, you know, it's wild thinking back now, because I'm thinking about happy-go-lucky, polka-dot-wearing Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah, that's, I agree with the match quality that he had in WWF, because I really like his stuff with the Macho Man and Million Dollar Man and things like that. And I will admit, the theme song of Common Man is one of my favorite wrestling themes of all time.
For sure. I mean, yes.
That opening cowbell and everything, like, I'm a sucker for a cowbell. So. But yeah, I never thought, like, even when I've gone back, I forget what Survivor Series it is. I want to say 91 or 92. I think it was 91. And they have all the wrestlers out there saying what they're thankful for. And one of my favorites is Roddy Piper saying that he's thankful that he's not Ricky Rude and kisses the camera. But Dusty always cracks me up because the only thing he says is, "I'm thankful for my polka dots."
For my polka dots, yeah, that was 89.
Okay, oh, that just cracks me up. But yeah, I don't mind 80s or 90s Dusty in the WWF. I think it was good that he at least tried it, because when I look back now on Crockett TV, and then you listen to the various shoot interviews and stuff, Dusty was way past his expiration date in Crockett TV. And it made all of the sense in the world that he left. Because, I mean, when you're kind of burying the Rock and Roll Express and teams like that and people like that, it's time for you to go.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard Ricky Morton tell the story multiple times about how the only reason, like, Dusty didn't want them to get over, but then when he found out that they were getting over no matter what, that's why he did the six-man tags with him and stuff. And, you know, like, I hate to speak illy of Dusty, you know, he's not with us anymore, but, you know, I feel like he had that mindset of not necessarily that he didn't want someone to get over, but he still really wanted the spotlight. You know, he was so used to it. He had been an attraction for years. You know, back in the early and mid-80s, they said the two biggest attractions in professional wrestling were Andre the Giant and Dusty Rhodes. So I really feel like he couldn't let go of that in a way. So he wanted to be there. So that's why he put himself with the Road Warriors. That's why he put himself with the Rock and Roll Express. You know, that's why he tried to, you know, which and it ultimately got him the boot by TBS and from Turner in Crockett era, was that angle where he turned the Road Warriors heel. He stuck around for a little bit after, but, you know, he did the big blade job on TBS when that was a big no-no. And they had just kind of turned that, like, hey, look, no more blood on TV. You can do it on your big shows, not on TV anymore. Dusty kind of ignored it, you know. So he was fired, not from the company, but from being a writer. And, you know, he stayed around for a little bit. But in a way, I feel like it might be the best thing to happen to him. You know, he got to step away from that a little while. He didn't have any responsibilities in WWF. I mean, for years, he had the book, you know, with Crockett. Then he left for WWF. And, you know, he got to just have fun again, just be a performer, and he hadn't done that in years. Then he came back to WCW early 91, got to book again. And honestly, I mean, your average fan, what do they remember? They remember WWF Dusty, because that's what got the most exposure.
Right.
Had he not gotten that, do you think that Dusty Rhodes would be as big of a, as remembered as he is? Because you look at some other guys, you know, okay, perfect example. Somebody like Jack Briscoe. Jack Briscoe is considered one of the best workers of all time, one of the best heavyweight champions NWA ever had. Not even a quarter of the people that might know who Dusty Rhodes is probably knew who Jack Briscoe was.
Right.
So I'm wondering if he would be as well known. Would he be more on the level of, say, like a Tully Blanchard? You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, we can't answer that, but I think that WWF run helped his longevity as far as your public eye.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, you can say what you will about how big of a show like Starrcade was for Crockett, but it seemed like to me like Starrcade was only big for, you know, the Crockett fans. Like, typically WWF fans probably weren't going to go buy Starrcade. So when he makes that jump and he's, you know, goes to a WrestleMania and he goes to SummerSlam and he goes to those bigger pay-per-views, I totally agree. I think the WWF really helped him out longevity-wise as far as his exposure. Because I think if he hadn't jumped, what's the next biggest thing that he does? I would say the next biggest thing that he does is join the NWO in the late 90s. And even that, I mean, he really didn't get that big of an exposure. I mean, it was kind of a big deal that he left the booth and joined the NWO. But other than that, I mean, that was it.
Well, little known fact, a lot of people don't know this. But when he first left the NWA, he didn't go straight to WWF. In the middle of 88, somewhere around there, he actually went back down to Florida and tried to revive the territory.
Right. Yeah, he did that.
And, you know, it didn't work out. So you wonder if Dusty would have been one of those guys that kind of floated around. Because if, let's say that they couldn't come to any term and Vince didn't want him, mm-hmm. or whatever, they couldn't agree to whatever. Well, he's obviously already gotten the boot from Crockett. So does he go to, I mean, is Japan something that Dusty at that age would have done? Would he have just kept trying to be in a, you know, running a promotion? Could he have, I mean, you think about different things like Herb Abrams, UWF, you know, could he have been possibly a part of that? You know, things, it's hard, man. You don't really know what could have happened to Dusty. That being said, would Dusty Rhodes be as fondly remembered without that?
Well, he probably would have done it in the UWF only if he liked baby oil, cocaine, and hookers like Herb Abrams did.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
That's why they, you know, that's why they call him a Herbo Turbo.
Oh, Lord Jesus. This is taking a turn.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't care.
Bringing it back, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question because... I've heard the story about him going back and trying to revive Florida, and if I can recall correctly, I think even in Florida he was using guys like Bob Backlund and stuff, and I just think that that wasn't gonna work. So
it could have been just who was available to him. You got to think around that time who was wrestling that wasn't in those top promotions.
Right.
It's hard to, you know, so.
But I've often,
unless it's new guys.
I've often wondered this then, and let me ask you this. At this time, say he doesn't go. Say he, you know, he's, you know, just floating around not doing anything, and the WWF doesn't want him, and WCW doesn't want him back. Do you think Jim Cornette asked him to come and help and do Smoky Mountain Wrestling?
Well, see, it's possible, because I think Smoky Mountain would have started up around 91, I think.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's potential. It's hard to tell, man, because I mean, that's a long time in between. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, Cornette didn't finally get out of his WCW contract until 91. I feel like Dusty would have figured out something on the booking end of somewhere.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I mean, honestly, it's a possibility that he could have been gone 6 months, come right back to NWA WCW.
Oh.
You know, I mean, it's hard, you know. It's a lot of guys around that time, you know, that kind of floated around, that you wonder, you know, because it wasn't too long. Dusty left the promotion right around the time, by promotion, I mean WWF. He left right after the Road Warriors came in. He got there right before Arn and Tully left. So he was around familiar company.
Right.
It's a shame that they didn't let him have those matches where, like, of course, you know, they're not going to reference absolutely anything that had anything to do with the competition. But, like, can you imagine, like, even with the goofy gimmick, could they have squeezed in something with Arn and Dusty? Or give Dusty somebody to team with to wrestle the Brainbusters?
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that I was highly disappointed with. When, you know, talking about like the team, like the Brainbusters, because, you know, Arn and Tully were so good as a unit, but they were also so good individually. That would have I would have thought that would have been really well, even if you just did like a Superstars taping or something, and having one of them, you know, take on Dusty, because you're right, there is a lot of history there.
And to me, in my opinion, what would have been the biggest money feud for a Dusty Rhodes run would have been against Akeem the African Dream, which was obviously a Dusty Rhodes kind of based off Dusty Rhodes type ripoff, kind of, you know, along the same lines. They didn't get a real feud. They did a few things on the house show, and that was it.
Right.
Like, I've often said that, I mean, even though I loved the feud they had with him and Macho King,
mm-hmm.
WrestleMania 6 had Akeem versus Dusty written all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And hell, they even had Dusty feud with the Boss Man, who was Akeem's partner.
Right.
And they even got higher profile matches than him and Akeem did, like more TV stuff.
Well, what's funny to me is, you know, you talk about Arn and Tully and the history they had with Dusty. Dusty had history with Big Boss Man in NWA when he was Big Bubba Rogers.
Right.
And, you know, Dusty, you know, took him under his wing and, you know, and helped him out along and stuff. And, I mean, there you go. And that translated well, I thought, to WWF.
Oh, most definitely. His run with Boss Man. I mean, maybe I'm just, I think about all these things. I got to remember Dusty wasn't there that long. Out of the three high-profile feuds that he had good opponents. I mean, he had Boss Man, he had Savage, and he had DiBiase.
Mm-hmm.
So he had good stuff. You know, I guess I'm just being greedy and I wanted more, you know.
Right.
So, and I just think him and Akeem could have done a little better business than they were able to do. You know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, and I agree. And I even liked a little bit of the stuff that you've seen towards the end of his run when Dustin got brought in and he's working alongside of him. Because,
right.
I mean, not that they probably would do it at that time, but you probably could have done, if he would have stuck around or they both would have stuck around, you could have done something like, you know, a father versus son match or something like that.
Oh, I honestly think that had they stuck it out, they might have even could have got a run with the tag belts. Something small, you know, just to have that moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And not to change the subject, but, like, with Dustin, those couple times that I've seen him in the WWF watching stuff back, I mean, I know that he's still kind of green at that point, but, man, was he good at that point.
Man, that's one of I'm such a huge Dustin Rhodes fan. That fucker was good. I was just talking about this recently. Around 94, I mean, Dustin was good from day one, just about it. I mean, when your dad's Dusty Rhodes, you better fucking be good. But by 1994 in WCW, Dustin had got it. He could have been, and, you know, you had Hogan coming in, so yeah, it's kind of drop everybody down the ladder. But let's pretend Hogan never came into WCW in 94. I easily believe that Dustin Rhodes could have been World Heavyweight Champion by 95, 96, and possibly, you know, he could have never left the company and gone to be Goldust. Whether that's good or bad, you know, it's for you to decide. But I really feel like he had World Champion written all over him.
Oh, I agree. I mean, if you look at any of the, you know, big-time wrestlers and their kids, I think Dustin and even Cody to an extent too, both have, to me, world heavyweight title talent. And given what you had at WCW at that time, it would have made perfect sense to have Dustin as champion. But I also wonder too how much of a pushback you're getting from the boys in the locker room, because Dusty comes back and he's now running the show, basically, at least the booking, and now he puts his kid as the champion.
Yeah, from what I understand, there was a lot of that going on. But, and to Dustin's credit, you look at the stuff that he got all the time he was in WCW, he never got as much as people like to swear that Dustin was giving him. Sure, he got a run with the U.S. title, a couple, if I'm not mistaken, but he was never really pushed down anyone's throats. The only main event Dustin Rhodes ever got was in 93? It was a War Games match. Him, Dusty, and the Nasty Boys won a War Games match against, I believe it was Harlem Heat, Arn, and Terry Funk? I could be wrong about that. No, was it Arn? No, maybe it was Bunkhouse Buck. Hell, I can't remember. But it, I know that, goddamn it, that Harlem Heat was in it. I might be mixing a Dustin Rhodes feud with the Studs Table later on. I swear Funk was in that match, too. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, I got the game streaming on my phone, or I'd look it up for you.
No, it's fine. I'm looking it up now.
No, but while you're looking it up, I'll agree that I don't think... By saying that I think that the locker room would probably not like it, I agree that I don't think that Dusty, you know, legitimately was going out there to push him hard. I think that he put him at least in some good spots and then just seen how he would handle it. I think that if you even look at, like, you know, something years down the road with Ric Flair and his kid David, I think that's complete opposite of what Dusty and Dustin had. And not saying that was all Ric Flair's doing, but, I mean, I think you got that shoved down your throat a lot more than you did Dustin.
Oh, David was so bad. Oh, God. And correction, so Dustin had at least two pay-per-view main events. The 93 War Games match was Sting, Davey Boy Smith, Shockmaster, and Dustin Rhodes against Harlem Heat, Sid, and Vader. The 1994 Fall Brawl War Games match was the Dusty, Dustin, and Nasty Boys team against Terry Funk, Arn Anderson, Buckhouse Buck, and Colonel Robert Parker. So I was close. I just mixed 2 years together.
No, that's fine.
So Dustin did get two main events. Either way, okay, so maybe in 93 he did get pushed because he does seem very awkward in that group. Mm-hmm. But in 94, by no means, he deserved getting that push.
Right, and my mind's a little foggy as far as Dustin and WCW. Didn't he have a couple matches with Steve Austin that were pretty good?
Dustin?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, yes. Those guys, they feuded at least twice that I can remember. They had a pretty good match at Starrcade 93.
I think that's what I remember is the Starrcade 93 match.
Yeah. But, you know, they had great chemistry, which is why I always wished that Goldust had got more of a push during the time that Austin was the champion, because I know they could have, and they did wrestle in WWF a few times, mm-hmm. but they didn't get to have, like, a story. Like, I think that they could have really told a good story.
Well, I know we... Gary and I went to a SmackDown taping or whatever, probably about 2-3 years ago. And it was switching out between, I think, Superstars and SmackDown. So they had a match in between. And it was the Ascension when they were still in NXT versus the Rhodes Brothers with Goldust and Stardust. And I know how old, you know, Dustin is at this time. Man, he was so fucking smooth in that ring.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys. Good God. And, I mean, you know, I forgot how tall he is, as one thing. But then, you know, you think about his age, but man, was he smooth.
Oh, God. I almost think, okay, so from around, was it 2003, 2002? When he did that feud of Evolution?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, until, from about that point, you know, he left the company not too long after that, for reasons. And, you know, he did all this stuff, TNA, he got grossly out of shape. You know, he had his demons, and, you know, which is a shame. But his talent really dropped off from that, be it laziness, be it because of his addiction, or whatever. Then when he had that next run again, because from what I've always known, he was never actually supposed to get a run. When they kind of did a whole angle where they brought him back, he wasn't under contract. but he made it a point to get in the best shape of his life. You know, he had lost more weight. He was in just as good a shape, if not better, than when he was had his peak in like 93, 94. So he started doing fucking Hurricane Ranas and those flipping sunset flip bombs and shit. You know, yeah, I mean, I would say he was almost a better worker than he was back then.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm super fucking excited for this heel run of his, if it's done like I think it's going to be. You know, I really feel like it could give him one last good, solid run.
Yeah.
If they try to take it back to the original Goldust character, which I know we covered that a little bit on our, well, I want to call it our 95 episode, but I don't know if it was much of a 95 episode or not. But things that he could have done, and I think he's not going to be as raunchy with the character now because, you know, the world's a lot touchier. But, John, I just, that's another time. I feel like if they didn't have to drop the character back, you know, they wanted to be, they had to appeal to the masses in 95, 96, and they not turned him face, I almost fucking believe he could have been a believable heel to beat Shawn Michaels for the title in 96.
I agree, and I think that it would have made a lot more sense because, given the time, that's probably one of the reasons why I don't mind Shawn's run at that point, but I think that he had better title runs later on because he didn't have the amount of quality of heels to work with, whether because of, you know, his issues with Vader, and I mean, I don't consider Sid that great of a worker, but then there you got Goldust, and I think that would have been a perfect feud for him to have, especially given how, you know, Stripper Boy-esque Shawn Michaels is at that point, and given what Goldust is at that point. It makes perfect sense. But, like you said, they have to pull back a little bit because, I mean, while kayfabe might have been dead at that point, and, you know, the heat isn't exactly there, there was legitimate heat when he would go places.
Oh, yeah, for fucking sure, man. I, still there. And if you still haven't done it, go back. You know, I know there's at least one on YouTube. Him and Goldust and Shawn had a pretty good ladder match at a house, and they did a string of those house shows. God, man, just stuff like that. Like, I wish, you know, he could have got a better run with Taker. You know, it's so much, you know, I can play Fantasy Booker all fucking day of, you know, different things you could have done with Goldust, or different things you could have done with Dusty and WWF. You know, it's a, you know, so far I think it's been this episode, all I've talked about is how different things we could have done with Luger, Dusty, and Dustin so far.
Yeah. Well, circle back a little bit about Dusty. So a lot of people talk about his 80s run and the WCW Rocket or whatever. And I know there is a decent amount of footage that the WWF probably hasn't released yet of his stuff in Florida. But just hearing the stories of Dusty in Florida in the 60s and 70s, it might be on YouTube. If it is, you know, people, you know, send me a link or let me know. I would love to have been there to see when Dusty, who is it a heel at this point, with Gary Hart turns on him. And I'm trying to remember who Gary Hart was also managing at the time.
But, oh man, it was a Japanese, yeah. Damn it. I can't remember. There's a small clip of it on Dusty's DVD.
Is it?
But it's not a lot. In my head, I keep saying Kabuki, but I know it wasn't the Great Kabuki.
I want to say T-Joe Khan, but I don't think that's it either.
That sounds right, but I'm not sure, to be honest with you.
But yeah, and then from there, you know, he becomes the American Dream and really explodes. And while his 80s stuff is good, and you get the Hard Times promo and stuff, his stuff in the 70s is just fantastic, especially when it's him and superstar Billy Graham.
I actually found it, It was Pack Song.
Pack Song, that's it.
Yep, and it's the whole thing is actually on YouTube. If you just look up Dusty Rhodes Babyface Turn 1974, because it was him and Pac Song against Mike and Eddie Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, that's awesome that that's there. I had no idea.
Yeah,
cool. Okay, there you go. Is the full? Well, not the full, but as full as you're gonna get for 1974 match wise. Because you know back then they didn't. They did do some full matches, but for the most part. They clipped it down for television, and they never kept those master copies because they just recorded over the old stuff.
Right.
What you know is always the story. Have you heard? Okay, this has nothing to do with Dusty Rhodes, but I'm just going to tell this story anyway. So we talked about this a little bit on the very first episode, the Last Battle of Atlanta. So these stories... There was two different stories that came out about why the footage didn't exist, which we later found out it did. Number one was that Ole Anderson, as a way of saving cost, would just record over old shows instead of having to buy a new film. And the other version was that he either purposely recorded over it or purposely destroyed it or whatever when Georgia got sold to Vince. Because he didn't want Vince to ever have a copy of, I guess, his masterpiece. Well, the way it was found was it was just, like, there was a box of tapes from the WCW buyout.
Mm-hmm.
It was old, I don't know if they were VHS tapes or just rolls of film or whatever. And all the tape said was old Omni matches. So some fucker that works at WWE headquarters in the film department was just like, huh, let me put this one in and see what this is. Can you imagine being that guy that found what was believed to be the Holy Grail? Because, I mean, I know for a good solid 10 years, and that's just of my time in finding out about it from probably about 2007 to now before it got released last year. People looked everywhere for it. People were claiming they had the film, and then no one ever had anything. And then, I mean, yeah, it was ultimately... I have personally not talked to a single person that wasn't let down by that. But you're talking about stuff that they might have, they haven't released. Can you imagine, like, I tell that story just to get to this point, the amount of stuff from somewhere like Florida, somewhere like Georgia, you know, all kinds of... The Memphis stuff they have, they don't own all the Memphis stuff, but they own a chunk of it. And it's a lot of stuff I've heard they won't release due to the quality of it. Not that the picture might not be messed up, but some of it's like, back then, those big arena shows. See, it was wrestling in the 80s was ass backwards as opposed to what it is now. They had their high-dollar cameras for TV and the squash matches, and they did all that. When they did these big arena shows, which would be equivalent to a pay-per-view now, like Memphis specifically, they had one hard cam. And they had, you know, the announcer doing the commentary live over the PA system.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard WWE just still, they don't like how it's presented, so they won't release it. Which is horseshit, man. I mean, wrestling fans want it no matter what. So it's no telling the amount of shit they are sitting on that no one will ever see.
Yeah, and I know everybody, I know at least... at least one or two people that I've met through Facebook or whatever said that you go that they've toured the archives for WWF or WWE for jobs and stuff, and you know what, they're like, it's unbelievable the amount of stuff that they got there that still hasn't been put up yet. I agree, it's a shame because there are some things that I know of that I would like to see that I know aren't out there, at least I haven't found it through whether it's YouTube, Daily Motion, or whatever. And I'm hoping that the WWF has it and that we'll release it eventually. I think one of the big things for me is I know that they've done Junkyard Dog and Michael Hayes in different companies, but I wanted to say it's either Memphis, or it's either Georgia or Mid-South. One of the two that is out there, but there's one of them that's not out there, but the basic gist is Michael Hayes sprays the junkyard dog in the eyes with the hair stuff. And Junkyard Dog comes out and cuts a promo saying that he's mad at Michael Hayes because not only did he, you know, attack him, but he sprayed that stuff in his eyes. And Junkyard Dog had just had a daughter, or his wife just had a daughter, and he hasn't been able to see her because he's blind. And just really revved up that feud, and they had that match. I think it was, I want to say it was at in New Orleans. Or it might have been in Georgia, one of the two, I can't remember, but anyways, but that apparently hasn't been seen before since they had that match, and I guess they said it's one hell of a match. I would really like to see that.
I'm gonna go on record as saying that it's hard for me to believe that Michael Hayes had a good match.
Well, yeah, I mean, think about, I think Junkyard Dog is, I mean, he's not like a superstar by any means, but I definitely see his appeal at that time. And I mean, I know he consists of a headbutt, the thump, and, you know, a tackle, and I think he'll bite you or something. But
yeah, and I love Junkyard Dog, but he was not the best professional wrestler.
Right.
So yeah, it's, I don't know, I'm with you. But then again, sometimes, and I've seen plenty of matches like this, and witnessed it live, you could have two guys, whether they're the best wrestlers in the world or the worst wrestlers in the world, you have the right crowd behind you, you don't have to do anything. Which honestly was a lot of, at that era, too.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to have been, you know, in a place like Atlanta or New Orleans, and you hear, and they would say, like, you would, you know, the guy, the heels in the locker room would tell you, like, you know, you're sitting in the locker room and you can hear the fans doing the Junkyard Dog chant and how loud it was, and you couldn't even hear yourself freaking think. I would love to be there. So even if it is a shit match, just the fact that the crowd is that red hot would be fantastic.
Okay, I've often said that, like, people like talk about if time travel was ever possible, what would you do? I was like, man, I've got a list of wrestling events off the top of my fucking head that I would just want to sit in the crowd. I don't give a shit if I'm nosebleeds, just to be there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just, I mean, stuff like that. Like, I wish that, I mean, I love what wrestling is now. You know, it's evolved into something of its own. But in the same sense, man, wrestling, as far as wrestling fans, are just not the same, man. Back when people really believed, man, I would kill for an audience like that to a certain extent. I mean, I'm kind of spoiled because being down here in the Mid-Atlantic in the South area, you know, you do honestly still get a lot of those fans that really believe, you know. Man, a true story is I had a guy, he didn't pull it out, but I had a guy flash his gun that he had in his pants to one of the heels a couple of months ago. So that was the closest I ever got to, like, one of those Puerto Rico stories where somebody gets stabbed or something. I did have a guy flash his gun at a heel. He got so hot. So, you know, you still get a little bit of that. But for your mass majority, people don't believe and people don't care as much. I mean, the world's different as a whole anyway. So, and social media, in a way, has really ruined professional wrestling in that sense. I won't say it's ruined it, but, like, it's hard to watch something and truly believe these two guys hate each other.
Well, when it comes to social media, I feel like guys like The Revival and even Kevin Owens, and I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting, but they're just off the top of my head right now, that use it right. You know, you're going to have fans that are going to talk shit to you. So if you're a heel, fucking do it. Talk shit back. Who gives a fuck?
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. What I don't like is that when people try to further their angles on social media, like, it, to a certain extent, like, if it's like, I've seen where, like, Kevin Owens, I always thought when he would do it and kind of shit on Goldberg, I enjoyed that, because it's not like he's cutting a full promo on him, because I see guys do that shit and they're cutting promos on Facebook. It's like, shut the fuck up, don't, but if you want to send something shitty, like send a little shitty tweet, that's funny, because, you know, you're doing just enough to press, because I thought it was funny, because Goldberg would kind of seriously respond to him. Mm-hmm. And you could see Owens was just dicking off and just doing what he wanted to.
Right.
What I want to see is the eventual collision between Cody and the Revival.
Oh, my God.
That's the feud that we all want to see, damn it.
And it's funny, too, because, like, you would think that the Young Bucks would be the ones, you know, going, oh, the Revival, blah, blah, like, that could be, like, Midnights and Rock and Roll down the road. But it's Cody Rhodes, who's not even an attack team. And whether they're, I'm sure they're hamming it up for the computer, the camera and stuff, but, like, the Bucks legitimately are looking like, you know, holy shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love it every time. They just look around like, what the fuck did he just say?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I love shit like that. And they could be playing towards, you know, something else. You know how they are. The Bucks are ingenious on things like that, using, like, their little web series, being the Elite, stuff like that, to kind of further angles on their own. Like, this whole Marty Scurll being in the Bullet Club was set up for forever on their show. And they just made it happen in Ring of Honor. You know, little stuff like that. I feel like they could be teasing Cody leaving the Bullet Club, doing something small like that, and he's going too far, and they're kind of going, hey, man, calm down, what the fuck? You know, that's not an angle for any promotion. That's them dicking off.
Right.
But, you know, they are part of the reason why wrestling is so different today in a good way.
Right.
They're teaching everybody how to make money at this shit.
Right, and I'm okay with that. And I know, like, some of the old school guys aren't as far as some of the stuff the Bucks do and Omega and stuff, but or even, like, people like Joey Ryan. But the problem I have with social media and wrestling is if you're the WWF, you have guys like Bray Wyatt has a Twitter account. Why? Even Dean Ambrose, why does he have a Twitter? Motherfucker's supposed to be unhinged. And he's not going to check how many likes he's got on a fucking post. And then you have...
And he doesn't.
Right. And then you got Charlotte, who, I mean, now she's a babyface. But even when she was a heel, she might, you know, send out a heelish tweet or something. But then you look like 5 tweets later, she's hanging out with Becky Lynch. It's like, why? That's not what this is for. I mean, I get it, you're supposed to be characters and everything like that, and Hunter's one of the ones that helped kill kayfabe, but come on.
It's one of those things, I don't even mind if they completely kill kayfabe on their social media, but pick which one you want to do, whether you're going to be in character or whether you're going to use this as your personal account. You know, like me personally, okay, I have my Twitter, which is, I barely use it. I should use it more, but I barely use it. I mainly use my Facebook account. I've got my personal Facebook account that I'll share, like, wrestling events and stuff. And I might share, like, a video, that like, a promo. But I'm not going to, like, I am not the professional wrestler on my social media. I'm me. I've also got a separate Facebook page that you can go like. And that is 100% the professional wrestler me. So I know, and I go back to this one, Cody Rhodes was really good about that. See, in WWE, when he became Stardust, he switched his Twitter over to full-on Stardust. He made a separate Cody Rhodes account for his personal shit. So, I mean, that extra little bit was nice, you know. I will say something that's really funny about Dean Ambrose's Twitter account is if you read like his bio or whatever, unless it's changed, originally all it said was, they made me get this. And that's all it said. And he like retweeted like one or two things from WWE and just never used it again.
Right. I mean, no, I get why the WWE does it. I just think that, and I know they think about wrestling in a completely different way, but I mean, I don't know. I could go on and on about current pro wrestling is why I hate some of the things I do, and I probably sound like I'm an 80-year-old, you know, man, you know, because I hate fans that chant, this is awesome, and holy shit, or fight forever, and it's like, you know, if you do that, that's fine, but if you do that and you're sitting beside me, just go down a few more rows. I don't want to sit with you. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I can, if it's a genuine reaction, I feel it's different, but I think a lot of crowds just, they're trying to get themselves over.
Right.
More than anything, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean, even to kind of swing it back to the original topic, I mean, like, when you would hear, I know, like, I love those old studio shows. So when you hear, like, Dusty come out and stuff, like, you do hear, you know, some of the fans kind of trying to go into business for themselves. But there, it's not that bad. I can live with it there. It's when you have the main events or the matches or whatever, and, like, you know, you've seen, like, you know, whatever high spot it is, and it's like, you know, holy shit, you know, you get a chant, and it's like, okay, you've seen a backflip, or you've seen a moonsault, wonderful. Just pay attention to the freaking match that they're having right now. But,
oh yeah, no, I'm completely with you.
But, that's probably why I haven't watched the WWF in, probably since WrestleMania, so.
Yeah, I'm very guilty of skimming through shows. I dislike the current product, but I find it harder to watch it, like, and be invested in it. I've got friends that work there, you know, so I watch every Monday, I watch every Tuesday. I might miss the pay-per-views. But, I mean, I don't care. As mad as I get at wrestling, I watch as much of it as possible. I'm very guilty of that.
Well, that's why, like, you know, like I said in, I think, our first episode, I started watching wrestling in 95. So, I will admit that there are a lot of things that I've gone back and watched, and obviously Dusty Rhodes is one of them. But even, like, currently now, like, his son Cody, I know, even on our own Facebook group, a lot of people are, you know, I'll post stuff about Cody, and people are like, wow, Cody Rhodes, And even, like, Adam Cole, it's like, what are you watching? What do you see in those two gentlemen, especially even Cody? That's not fantastic, given what's going on.
I do not get it. Cody Rhodes is the future of professional wrestling. That motherfucker just gets it. Adam Cole is so fucking good, too, man. The only thing that he's got going against him is his height.
Right.
You know, but you look at somebody like AJ Styles, overcame that shit.
Right.
So, you know, I'm hopeful that somebody like a Kenny Omega, somebody like a fucking Marty Scurll, somebody like Adam Cole could come into WWE and make it. You know, I of course have my worries. They're not big on their small guys.
Right.
Look how long it took Daniel Bryan to get over.
Oh, absolutely.
But it just blows my mind. I feel like a lot of those fans just like to be different from everybody else. You know, they see the guys like the Omegas, like the Adam Coles, like Cody Rhodes, who are blowing up, who are the hottest things in indie wrestling. And they just want to shit on it because it's something everyone else likes. So they want to be against the masses.
Well, you know what? Here's a perfect example why I like Cody Rhodes. And I liked him before he became Stardust, and he was tagging with his brother. And I didn't see his clear face mask gimmick he had going on in the WWE.
Oh, I loved it.
But anyways, I didn't hit me until the ROH pay-per-view that they had WrestleMania weekend. I cannot think of the life of me for what it is. But anyways, so he's wrestling Jay Lethal in a bull rope match, and he talked about how his daddy made it famous and everything like that. Now, had this been the WWF, you probably would have had, you know, both wrestlers come out. Maybe the heels got the bull rope, and they're in their gimmick outfit or whatever. Not Lethal and Rhodes. They come out in jeans. You know, those old school T-shirts with, like, the screen printed, you know, wording on it. I forget what Cody said or whatever. And cowboy boots. And they wrestled like this was the freaking 80s and even the 70s. And I absolutely love it. And I'm like, this is the guy that gets it. Yeah, his dad wrestled in that time period and stuff, so he passed that down. But it would be easy for Cody to go, nah, I'll just do it this way, because that's what everybody else is doing. No, he does it that way. And I'm like, that's so refreshing, and that's why, like, I don't understand why people go, well, I like the Revival, but I don't like Cody Rhodes. Well, the Revival's doing the same thing Cody Rhodes is doing.
Oh, God, yes. It's all about finding a niche, man. People can find reasons to bitch about anything. Like, I remember, here's a perfect example. When CM Punk had his record-setting WWE title run, I had friends of mine who were all about Punk, okay? And I'm one of the first to admit that Punk's one of my absolute favorites. Now, it was about 3 to 5 months after, into that run, the 434-day run, they turned on him. Completely. It always had the belt too long. Oh, he needs to give somebody else a shot. They want their cake and eat it too. If wrestling fans are the greatest and worst people I've ever known, because I've never met some, I'm not saying every wrestler, I'm a professional wrestler, but I'm still a huge wrestling fan. Some people just want their cake and eat it too. They want the fucking, they are so wishy-washy on shit that it's sad. It's like, okay, another perfect example. Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan was just this phenomenon that should not have happened. But it happened, and they couldn't ignore it. He wins the title, finally, and truly has the title at WrestleMania 30. Now, albeit yes, within a couple of months he had that injury that ultimately ended his career. The fans almost instantly, within a 2-week span of him winning the belt, didn't give a shit anymore. It's like they want something because they feel like, oh, Vince McMahon doesn't want this, or, oh, the company doesn't want this, whatever, whatever. The second that person gets it, they shit on it. To go back a couple years, Seth Rollins, Tyler Black in Ring of Honor. The fans were so behind Tyler Black winning the title. The second he won the belt, they completely ass-turned on him.
Right.
It's just, shut up, shut the fuck up and enjoy wrestling, man. Like, I just want to tell people that so much sometimes.
Yeah, I get like that, because, like, I'll look when I was, because I think it was around, like, 2003 I stopped watching, because, you know, I was graduating high school, going into college and stuff, and I didn't get back into it till about 2013. Gary brought me back into it, and so it was right around when Daniel Bryan, you know, was winning at WrestleMania 30. But I was checking, like, seeing, like, how many, you know, because I was like, well, Bret Hart was one of my favorite champions. I wonder, you know, how many times so and so has won the belt. I see, like, Triple H has won it like 11 times, or Randy Orton. I'm thinking, man, that's a why? Why have so many titles? And then you see Bret Hart win it, like, say, like, I think 5 times or 4 times or whatever. But then I'm like, the titles mean something. But then I'll watch New Japan and I'll watch Naito throw the Intercontinental title around, and it's all bent up and chewed up, and I'm thinking, like, that's fucking great. He's just beating the shit out of that belt.
Which I have to admit, I have fucking loved all that.
Oh, yeah.
It's really something new you don't expect. The last time I saw anyone beat shit out of a title was when Mr. Perfect crushed the WWF title on Saturday Night's Main Event in 1990. Mm-hmm. You ever seen that?
No.
Oh, it was so nice. There's this whole angle. I can't remember what happens, but Perfect steals the belt from Hogan. I think he was wrestling the Genius, if I'm not mistaken. And Perfect takes the belt to the back and gets a hammer and live on air destroys the WWF title. And it was rumored that was actually what became the Hardcore title.
Right.
Because, you know, the Hardcore title was a broken winged eagle.
Mm-hmm.
It's later been said that that's not the case, that when Perfect broke the belt, someone actually, like, took that belt home and still has it to this day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just kind of wild that, think about the money that they had to just destroy a WWF title. On the air, with a fucking hammer. Just, let me beat the shit out of this and break it for no reason.
Oh, yeah.
I think the Naito thing was they saw the belt was slowly being fucked up, and they're just like, here, just use it for your gimmick, you know?
Well, that was a funny thing, because, like, when, you know, last night's Dominion show, he's walking to the ring, and he's bending the faceplate like it's a piece of tin. And he just, like, looks at it, laughs, and then he like, chop puts the motherfucker into the ring. And Tanahashi picks up the belt and looks at it, and you could just see this look of disgust on Tanahashi's face, that as the referee's holding the belt, and they're flapping that piece of metal over, and he's just like, ah, and then he just attacks him. I just thought that was just, it's just great.
You know, fucking for sure.
You know, you got Tanahashi, who actually gives a shit about the belt and the prestige behind it, because he's a veteran and he gets it, and then there's Naito, who just, you know, no fucks to be given.
Not at all. Which is, it's so refreshing to see that.
Right. And that's the thing, that when you look at it now, like, while I do miss the times, like, and wish that I was around for Dusty's run and guys like that, I mean, it is refreshing to see that there are some things that are a lot like an old school thing, or even something that's totally different, that's new, and it's not like gimmicky new where it's kind of like, ugh.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I just remembered, a little fun fact about Dusty that not a lot of people know. Now, if I'm wrong, someone finds this out, please correct me. But it's, to my knowledge, Dusty Rhodes was actually in the first ever casket match.
Huh.
Against Ivan Koloff.
Wow.
Yes. Now, the reason I know this is from Ivan Koloff himself. See, when I was a kid, Koloff lived somewhere locally around this area. And he used to do, like, little, not, I don't know what the word is, but like say a church would bring him in to do a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes, like the night before, if like either the church would let him or different places would let him, he would do this thing where he would bring a couple of tapes, and just it would be like a night to hang out with Ivan Koloff. So like me at the time, this was like maybe like 2001. So I'm only about maybe 12, 13 years old around this time, roughly something like that. So I knew who Ivan Koloff was, but at that time, at that age, I didn't fully understand the gravity of, you know, who he really was in the business. But I'd seen a couple of tapes there, and my grandpa told me who it was. So we're watching a few tapes, and it's an old tape. So they have a casket. Now think about like an actual casket someone gets buried in, not those huge WWF ones.
Mm-hmm.
The casket was in the middle of the ring. It was not on the outside. So they had to wrestle around the casket the whole time.
Right.
And Ivan Koloff was, you know, he was like, to my knowledge, this was the first ever casket match you ever had. And the finish of the match was, Dusty was in the casket. And the doors, or whatever you call it, was still open. And Ivan Koloff jumped off the top rope to do that big flying knee drop that he did.
Right.
Dusty rolled out, and Koloff knee dropped the thing, fell back, and Dusty slammed the doors on him. It's a hell of a finish.
That is.
But it's just wild to think about, one, a casket match where the casket's in the fucking ring, and two, to think of Dusty Rhodes and Ivan Koloff as the first ever casket match.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, I don't know what other casket matches you would have from then on, but yeah, I'm sure, you know, everybody associates that with The Undertaker and stuff, but that's wild.
It's, if you go back and look, like, it's hard to believe that, as to my knowledge, the first ever ladder match recorded is Bret Hart versus Bad News Brown in Calgary.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, he was Bad News Allen at the time.
Right.
Yes, as far as I, unless, there's another one, Bad News Allen versus Bret Hart in Stampede was the first ever ladder match.
Hmm.
Bret takes credit for bringing the ladder match to America. Because the first one that ever happened in America, or at the very least in WWF, was actually him and Shawn on like a house show run in like 93 when Bret was the WWF champion, or like late 92 to early mid 93. because they were doing, and there's actually an episode of like Superstars or like Wrestling Challenge or something. You can go find it, and they had a quick little ladder match, and Vince loved the idea, but he let Shawn use it. So, to your casual WWF fan, they don't know that the ladder match was really a Bret Hart thing. It was made out to be it was a Shawn and Razor thing. So, little stuff you can find. And he had, I think, at least one or two in Calgary.
Right.
But they were wild, too, because they had the really tall wooden ladders.
Yeah.
It was wild, man. It's so cool to go back and look at stuff like that.
Well, that's what even, like, the cage matches back then. When I started watching wrestling, I was used to the big blue cage. And then, obviously, then they transitioned to the Hell in a Cell. But the Hell in a Cell, I mean, those cages were no different than what you would see in Crockett and stuff or the Territory days. The only difference is there was barbed wire at the top with maybe no roof or whatever. So, you know, you couldn't climb out. And I remember them saying that the reason why... I don't know if it was for either Hogan or if it was for San Martino. I can't remember. But the reason why they did the cage the way they did in the WWF was for that. Because before, a lot of the cage matches where you just had to pin your opponent in the ring. And you couldn't escape out of the ring by climbing out or going through the door. And they said the WWF did that for, I want to say it was Bruno. They did it for Bruno so that way Bruno could, you know, could basically, you know, win no matter what. But I like those older cages with the barbed wire wrapped around the top and stuff, because I'm like, that's wild. Like, you don't see barbed wire used in the professional wrestling tool like Japan or ECW or whatever. So,
well, Crockett in 86, Dusty and Tully had a barbed wire match at one of the Great American Bash tours. The ropes weren't taken down, but they wrapped the ropes in barbed wire.
Oh, good lord.
Yes, you can go back and check that out. And I will, to touch on that, it was actually the blue barred cage was actually for Hogan.
Okay.
Because it debuted at WrestleMania 2. But they it's back and forth between that. Some people say they actually did it that way because of they knew that if King Kong Bundy tried to climb out of a cage, it would collapse. So they did that to reinforce it so that King Kong Bundy could do stuff to where he was climbing the cage.
Mm-hmm.
But WWF did not care in their head the way you want a cage match to escape.
Right.
So they kept it for years because it was a lot easier to go through instead of trying to climb up a fence.
Right.
You know? Which, I mean, I hate that WWF went back to the chain link fence because that set them apart. It was unique, you know?
Oh, yeah.
The only person that does a cage even more close to that is actually CZW. When they have a regular cage,
mm-hmm.
It's not full-fledged bars, but they have like a, it's squared so that you can put your foot in there and climb up it. But I think that's something that's missing, too. I would love a cage like that. Another thing, too, is, so the gimmick of the climb-out cage... Oh, God, I believe that began, it was either in California, I'm trying to find it now, it was either for Fred Blassie or it was for The Sheik, the original concept, because the concept of a steel cage match was to keep your opponents in the ring, so they couldn't escape. And they created the rules for the escape so that, and I can't remember who it was, their top star didn't have to get beat. I want to say it was The Sheik, but I want to say that they, like Fred Blassie might have been the first person ever wrestled in one.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea was it's like, so like, let's just pretend it was The Sheik, and I'll find out the logistics later, and probably next episode or something, I'll correct myself. But the idea of it was that they didn't want The Sheik to lose, or maybe The Sheik didn't want to lose. So to get around this, he would lose the match because someone escaped the cage, but he never got beat. So that was a way to save him, but also get the top babyface over, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, the story of the WWF cage, like I said, Cornette's the one that I remember hearing it on his drive-through, and I remember him saying something about Bruno doing something with the cage or whatever. But the WrestleMania 2 match with the cage, there's a good kayfabe commentaries with, it's called Super Card, and it's the first one's with King Kong Bundy, and he talks about his build up with Hogan for WrestleMania 2. He's got some really good stories on that whole thing. He hates Savage with a passion, but one thing about the cage though is that a lot of, and I don't think it's lost on a lot of people, that was usually your blow off to a lot of feuds, is, you know, you settled that in the cage, whereas nowadays it seems like it's just like, it's just kind of thrown into, like, well, let's spice up the feud a little bit and throw them in a cage.
It's so weird how people do certain gimmicks now, you know? To me, most gimmick matches should be the end of a feud. Be it a cage match, be it a ladder match, be it a whatever. Fucking, I wish to God they would bring back... You rarely ever see street fights anymore in a sense of... The last one I really remember anyone doing was, oh geez, how long ago has it been? 2013? 2012? The Chris Jericho and CM Punk one?
Okay, yeah.
They both wore jeans, Punk wore a t-shirt, you know, it was really a come as you are type street fight. I missed that, you know, back they had the bunkhouse matches,
right.
You know, Dusty Rhodes was the king of the bunkhouse match. You know, stuff like that. I miss little things where you're showing that extra little bit of attention. You know, it's
Dusty in those bunkhouse matches. They were all the guys were in blue jeans, cowboy boots, and some of them had like them big fucking belt buckles and everything. And it literally did it. It looked like a freaking street fight.
I will tell you though, the Bunkhouse Stampede 1988. It's one of the worst fucking matches I've ever seen in my life. I love Dusty Rhodes beyond belief. But god damn it. Where in his head did he think, let's have a battle royal where you throw the guys out of the cage? Made any sense?
Well, to me, it's what also on top of that, it's I'm Dusty Rhodes. I'm going to win just about every televised bunkhouse match. Except for the ones that I'm either not on the house shows or whatever.
Yeah, he did win all of them.
I'm like, really?
Yeah. Which, if you go and watch the 88 Bunkhouse Stampede, Arn Anderson had the smallest shirt you've ever seen in your fucking life. You know, in the 80s, that's how, you know, you want to cut your little belly shirt. He just barely had it covering his nips. It was the wildest looking thing, man.
You know, you're talking about a street fight, and the one street fight I remember, and it just comes to my mind, was WrestleMania 13 in Chicago, and they had the Chicago street fight, and it had the Legion of Doom, I think Draws, and Ahmed Johnson against, I want to say it was the Nation of Domination. And one of the promos, I don't know who cut it, if it was the Nation, or if it was the babyface team. But somebody said something about they're going to use everything but the kitchen sink. And then when they show the babyfaces walking down, there's Hawk fucking carrying a kitchen sink.
WrestleMania 13.
Yeah. I remember as a kid laughing at that, going, holy shit, he brought a sink.
That motherfucker brought the sink. Yep, I'm with you. That shit was fucking hilarious. And if you go back also, speaking of that match, and you watch during it, you'll see a fan, like, punch, I think it was Hawk or Animal a couple times in the arm, like he was really excited. Like, I'm not trying to beat him up. That kid was Colt Cabana.
Oh, really?
Yes. Go back and find that fucking street fight. Colt Cabana just randomly wails on, like, one of the Road Warriors' arms because he's so excited. They're down there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's something, like, you wouldn't see till down the road with, like Dean Ambrose bringing out a fucking potted plant or something like that. But just the fact that
yeah.
He brings out a fucking sink, that was great.
Oh, yeah. I love stuff like that in wrestling, man. Bring the wildest shit you can. Like, I love stuff like that. Like, I remember at one of the CZW Tournament of Deaths, right? There was a match. I want to say that John Moxley and Dean Ambrose was in this match, where they sat at the dinner table with dishes. And there was a china cabinet full of dishes. And they just beat the shit out of each other with fucking plates and bowls and shit. Like, I love outlandish shit like that. Like, I remember APA did this match. It was on some pay-per-view. It was the early days of the brand split years ago, like 04 or something, 02 maybe. And they had a barroom brawl. And they had a barroom set up next to the stage. Because I remember, like, Matt Hardy went on top of, like, something to try to leg drop somebody through a table, and it didn't work, so we had to do it twice. Mm-hmm. Like, I just, that was the one thing of an Attitude Era that I did enjoy. I know we've talked about how much we do not like the Attitude Era. Well, I can't wait. Because I feel like it's going to be me and you versus Gary, and that's going to be special. Yeah. But I one thing I did love was the hardcore title. Because I know you talked about, like, you're not a big fan of, like, unnecessary violence. Mm-hmm. The hardcore title was not that. Mm-hmm. The hardcore title was their comedy bit, especially when it was the 24/7 rule. Mm-hmm. So, like, you had stuff like Bob Holly and Al Snow fighting literally into the Mississippi River. Crash Holly was defending his title at UPlay and, like, sliding down slides and fighting the fucking headbangers in a ball pit.
Well, you've been like, you know, Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe fighting over that hardcore title.
I did up until they had an evening kind of match.
Well, yeah. I'm sure Pat liked it, but...
And Virgil.
But no, like, yeah, I agree. Like, I like the 24/7 thing. For those of you wondering why Mild Menace story, I just... The tons of headshots and stuff. It was when I look back on it now and I kind of cringe a little bit, knowing what we know now and stuff. So, like, that type of stuff for VCW when it's just like, well, we got two guys that can't wrestle a lick, so we're just going to beat the piss out of each other with fucking chairs and everything like that without telling a story. That's the stuff I don't like, but...
I think that, I mean... Now that people know what they know about, like, concussions and head trauma, people have gotten away from that. Even on the indies with these crazy-ass, like, death matches and stuff like that, you honestly still don't see a lot of it. They've gotten away from doing a lot of those crazy headshots and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I mean, some of the indie stuff that I've seen, it seems all, you know, it's fine. It's not until, like, that Okada-Shibata match where, you know, Okada's and Shibata are trading headbutts, and I'm like, guys, what the fuck? You know? But, I mean, poor Shibata, I mean, he got the bad end of that one, but...
And I feel so bad for him, because it was not needed, man. I get why he was doing it, mm-hmm. But holy shit, man... Like, I feel so bad for him, too, because I feel like he was really reaching a point in his career where he had figured things out. He was going to be a top star.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes to show, man, it's just, you don't need that shit. Yep. I hate getting hit in the head. People fuss at me all the time. It's like, you know, yeah, wrestling's not ballet. Yeah, you got to get hit. But, motherfucker, I'm throwing my hand up, and you're not going to crack me but so hard in the head. I've gotten one concussion that I know of. And at least two that I think I've gotten.
You can't remember.
I can't remember slash that I wasn't diagnosed, but getting one that was diagnosed and one that felt like they were close to one, man, it's fucking scary. I can only imagine these guys that have gotten multiple, and it's just not worth it, man. I love professional wrestling, but you gotta look out for your life. You know, there's safe ways. Okay, I'll tell you, one of the smartest men in professional wrestling is Jimmy fucking Valiant. That man, and I love him to death, could not wrestle his way out of a wet paper bag. The motherfucker was terrible.
Woo,
Lawrence than that ass.
Oh, yeah, that's what I said every time I watched one of his fucking matches. Now, and I had the most respect for Jim Vivek in the world. But shit, he was bad. That fucker, he's older than Moses, and still wrestling. Oh, if God. You can call it that, but he's still getting in the ring doing his shit. You want to know why? Watch his matches. How many times do you see him really get fucking nailed in the head, take huge bumps? You didn't.
No.
That's why you see guys like Foley are retired. He fucking killed himself.
Yeah.
Like Terry Funk can barely walk. Harley Race is confined to a fucking a motorized chair now.
Yeah.
You know, it's these guys that did. And Harley Race, man, okay, I mentioned Cactus and Funk, guys who did crazy shit, at least Funk later in his career. Let's just talk about Harley Race, a guy who retired before the era of the bad bumps. But Harley was a fucking breed of his own and was taking all these wild bumps.
It was just brought up on the Pritchard show, the 88 Hogan, where Hogan and him have a match, and Harley Race goes through a table. They didn't even gimmick the table. So he goes in there hard, and they said that's what pretty much ended his career right there,
was mm-hmm.
because he got seriously fucked up from that.
Yeah, only if he had internal injuries because of it.
Yeah, I mean, and I've watched that thing, and man, he gets fucking lit up.
And which, not for nothing, that's from a Saturday Night's Main Event, and I believe 87. Hell of a match.
Yeah, and then, but it's just crazy to think that, Bruce even said, because you know, we didn't think about that stuff at the time, about gimmicking, I think. But I've never gone through a table, but, I mean, gimmick or not, that looks like that fucking hurt.
Dude, I can only imagine, because it kind of gave away a little bit, but it's like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the earliest. I always thought that was the first table spot I'd ever seen, but I think that Savage and Ricky Morton did a pile driver through a table like a year prior.
Yeah.
In Memphis.
Yeah.
Or two? No, that was like 84, 85 when they did that.
Yeah. It was right around there, because yeah, because the pile driver was illegal there, and he does the, you know, Ricky Morton does that great sell, and then he pile drives him through that table and stuff. But yeah, that I would think mainstream wise, that's probably like one of the first ones that they ever seen.
Oh yeah, because a lot of people thought that it was Flair and Funk in '89.
Right.
And it's like, nah, sucker, there was a little more.
But talking about Boogie.
Oh God, we're going back to Valiant.
No, I was just gonna say, like, I listen to other podcasts and they talk about the greatness of the carny that is Jimmy Valiant.
Oh Lord Jesus!
And it just blows my mind, because everyone talks about Virgil and his stuff. But Boogie's no different. The only difference is people seem to like Boogie. Nobody likes Virgil.
Oh, okay.
Except for us. We love you, Virgil. We want you on the show.
That's the truth. All right, so I know I've told it to you, but just so for anybody that listens to this, I've got a hilarious Boogie story to tell. So this has been about 5.5 years ago. I'm only about a year into the business, and I've got my first kind of big opportunity is I get to be in a tag team with Jimmy Valiant against these two guys that we were feuding with at the time. The house drew about 350, 400, which is really good for this area. So I'm super fucking excited. Now, Jimmy Valiant, being the legend that he is, you know, you don't have to tell him when we're doing shit. You ask, if anything. So I ran, because we came up with this idea for a finish, because the promoter, I was one of the top baby faces. I was one half of the tag champs. My partner was injured, quote unquote, which is why I'm teaming with Jimmy Valiant. So the finish was I was supposed to do a big victory roll onto one of the heels, and all Jimmy Valiant had to do was hold the foot of one of the heels. But still, me being the respectable rookie that I was at the time, I went up to Jimmy Valiant, and I was like, yeah, hello, sir. you know, in our match tonight, I was wondering if it'd be okay if you grab so and so's foot. It'll be at this point right here, blah blah blah. He's like, oh yeah, brother, that's fine. You know, whatever you want, daddy, blah blah blah. And I'm not exaggerating that shit. Like, what you hear in a Jimmy Valiant promo is what the fuck you get 24/7. That motherfucker is the boogie woogie man when he opens his eyes and when he goes to sleep. So anyway. So I told this guy I used to wrestle with named Jason. He trained at Boogie School. I said, Jason wanted me to tell you. He said hello and blah blah blah. And he goes, oh yeah. And he opens his book up and he goes, that's him right here in this class. And then, do you know so and so? And I was like, oh yeah, I know this one, I know that one. He goes, oh yeah, brother, if they was in this class. And he's flipping through his pages and he's like, I got all my classes in here from this year and this year and this year. He goes, and he closes his book. And he makes eye contact with me, and he said, I'll sign this book and sell it to you for $15. And I'm looking at this man, and I'm like, I'm your fucking tag team partner tonight. I'm not one of these fans. Stop trying to sell your shit to me. But what I say to him was, Boogie, I don't know. Let me see how I do on the gimmick table, I'll let you know later. So, yeah, I left it at that. So, we have our match. He packs up and goes home. Well, I'm talking to the promoter later at night. Tell the promoter that story, thinking he'll get a kick out of it. And he goes, you should have fucking took that. And I'm like, why? He goes, well, so what? This is, I won't say names, but the guy that paid to bring him into the show that night, say, he charged him $30 for that shit. And then I'm like, damn, I should have took it. They gave me the partner discount.
Well, that's like...
Go ahead. No.
Well, that's like, where I went to college at, is a small little college called West Liberty University, and it's 10 minutes outside of Wheeling, West Virginia. So the closest mall is in a town in Ohio called St. Clairsville. So one day, me and a couple fraternity guys said, well, what the fuck, well, let's go to the mall. I had nothing else to do on campus. So we get out of the mall. So we're walking through this mall. Now, there's no food court, there's no nothing. So but the middle of the mall is just wide open. So I see a guy sitting on this pillar, but it also has like kind of like a square thing that the pillar's sitting on. So this guy is sitting on this thing. And I'm looking at this guy, I'm like, he looks familiar. So as I got closer and closer, I'm looking, I'm like, holy shit. It's Virgil. So, he's just sitting there. He's got no bags. He's not shopping. He's got his Adidas, you know, warm-up pants on and a t-shirt. He's just sitting there just watching people walk by. And I walk by, and him and I make eye contact. So he knows that I know who he is. Because he comes over to me. He's introduced himself, and he's talking with me. He offers to give me an autograph just for $10. I'm like, I know I have $10 on me, but nah, I'm cool. I'm cool, Virgil. And like, I think he wanted to also hit me up for some money, as far as like, hey, can I borrow a few bucks? But I just like was like, oh no, thanks. But you know, I appreciate everything you did. And I just kept right on walking. My buddies are like, who is that? I was like, don't worry about it.
I've heard a lot of stories about Boogie, like, just kind of, I had a buddy of mine that, when he was younger, he went to a show, and he was looking at this stuff, right, and he picked up his mask on one of Boogie's gimmick tables, he's looking at it, and he goes, oh, brother, you like the mask? And he goes, oh, well, yes, sir, I like it a lot. He said Boogie took it from him, autographed it, and gave it back to him, and he goes, oh, thank you, sir, and he goes, all right, brother, that'd be $10. And he's like, wait a minute, what? He had to go get his dad to give him $10 to go pay Boogie because he fucked him out of him. I have another funny Boogie story. This isn't my story. I'll keep names safe just in case if this ever came out, in case he didn't want this story told. But a buddy of mine I used to wrestle with he was trained at Boogie School. So the gimmick is Boogie finds certain people to drive him around. Boogie doesn't drive. So he had this one wrestler that I'll keep names out. He drove him for years to shows. And he said that Boogie told him a story one time that, see, they always, back in the 80s and hells, till to this day when I go and do shows, to keep down on cost, you know, you have two guys walk into the hotel and you're like, hey, we need one room, two beds, and you pile like six guys in the room, you know, four to six guys, so you got people sharing beds and sleeping on the floor, sleeping under the tables, stuff like that. So Boogie said that one night him and Jake Roberts shared a bed. Well, and my buddy said this is a true story, even to this day, at like however fucking old Boogie is, which is old. Old as fuck. Boogie sleeps in a cutoff t-shirt, like belly shirt, and that's it.
Oh, good Lord.
No underwear, nothing. Dick out. So Boogie, apparently, according to him, has slept this way for as long as he can remember. Cutoff shirt, that's all. So he shared a bed with Jake Roberts. And Jake Roberts only slept in his tidy whities. So you have Jake the Snake Roberts on one side of this bed in his underwear, and you have the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant, beside him in only a cutoff shirt. Boogie said that they were so fucked up that they went to sleep that somehow he woke up the next morning and he was wearing Jake's underwear and Jake was wearing his shirt. I don't give a shit how many fucking mental scars I would have from it. I would pay to have seen what the fuck ever happened for that to happen. Because that can only be a hilarious story. It's just, and going back to Boogie still to this day sleeping that way. Mm-hmm. Same thing. Him and Boogie had to share a bed one night. And my buddy's like closer to my age. He's like, you know, between 25 and 30, somewhere in there. And so what he did was he went downstairs to the office or like the head, like the desk, and was like, hey, look, I get really, really cold. Can I get like two more comforters? Because he knew what Boogie was going to sleep in. So he comes upstairs and he like makes, like almost makes a body pillow out of the comforters to put in between them. So he said that, so they go to sleep, right? And he said he wakes up in the middle of the night because he hears this noise. It's like a crinkling. It's like a... And he wakes up and he's like, the fuck is that? You know, when you first wake up, your eyes are real blurry, so you're trying to focus, see what the fuck's going on. And he says, just the silhouette of the moon is coming in through the window. And he sees Boogie, dick hanging out, standing up, like all of like 4 feet away from him, opening up a cough drop. He said, I didn't get to sleep for the rest of the night because all I had was Boogie's dick in my dreams. I can only fucking imagine. And Boogie's weird, man. He's the only guy from young, old. That fucker shows up to the, if he has to have his wrestling tights on, right, he shows up to the arena in his wrestling tights. And he leaves in the arena in his wrestling tights.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I had heard on a different podcast, somebody was talking about him, and they said that, I guess, years ago, Boogie had cut an album. And I think the promotion had sold it or whatever. But anyways, on one of the various Facebook groups, this person, or it might have been in one of the wrestling forums, had said that they would really like a copy of this album for their collection. And somebody had given them the name of Big Mama and how to get a hold of him. So he messaged Big Mama and said, you know, I'm a big fan of, because I think there was divorced this time, and he said, you know, I'm a big fan of your ex-husband's, and I heard that you have some of the albums, and he said, I'd be really interested in getting one. So she gave him, like, a price, I think it was, like, $20 or something, like, for him. But anyways, so he said, like, all of a sudden, he didn't hear from her whatsoever. So he's like, well, maybe she's, you know, waiting or whatever, doing something. So he lets it go for about a week or two. So after about the third week, he messages her. And she hops on his ass and tells him to quit being, like, you know, like pretty much like a stalker and pestering her, that Boogie has all his stuff in a storage unit, and, you know, since they're divorced, she has to find time to go over there and ask him for an album so she can sell it to him. He said, needless to say, that he never got the album.
That's probably because she tried to, and Boogie was like, fuck you, give me the money.
Probably. Or I'm going to charge that guy $40 for his for that album.
You damn right. I love Jimmy to death, but that motherfucker is all about his money. It's you going to pay him or not. I don't give a shit who you are, whether you're the guy that brought him in or the guy that's fucking that paid for a ticket or the guy that's making the popcorn. You paying him, damn it. He's as old school as it gets. He is a carny. I'll tell you somebody else who is similar. I'm not going to say he's too bad, but that's Bill Eadie, Axe, Mass Superstar. I have not seen him but once since I was in the business. Had a really pleasant experience. I saw him in the parking lot, offered to carry his bags, and shot the shit with him for like 30 minutes, which was fun. But right before I got into the business, I was super excited because Demolition is probably my all-time favorite tag team. And I found out they were going to be on this event that was about 3 hours away that two of my buddies were wrestling at. I'm like, I got to fucking go. I got to fucking go. So I went, and I had this huge poster. See, this is back when Mattel, they were still very early on into the game of WWE figures, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And actually, no, it's almost, wow. Yeah, it's actually about 6.5 years ago now this happened. Damn, time fucking flies. So I had ordered a bunch of action figures from ringsidecollectibles.com, and they sent me a free poster of the Legend Series 4 figures. And Series 4 was Axe and Smash, Ultimate Warrior, Hillbilly Jim, Paul Orndorff, and I cannot for the life of me remember who the sixth person was. Hell, it might have been just those five. But anyway, so I'm like, look, I'm going to bring this poster to the event so I can get them to sign it. So I got there, and I hate, especially the names, the people who had to travel to get there. I hate to see, like, to be that guy that would go up to them and be like, hey, sir, can you sign this for me, and not buy anything from them. So I decided I wanted to buy an 8x10 of Demolition, but I also was going to get him to sign this poster for me. That's mainly what I wanted. And $10 for a picture, right? And he goes, all right, it'll be $20. Kind of looked at him, and I was like, I just want one picture. He goes, yeah, two autographs. I'm like, but this is my poster. I was so accidentally defensive. I guess he could see it. And he was like,
right.
He goes, oh, well, I'll do both for 15 since you brought that. And I'm like, all right, I'll do it. And I saw Smash beside him kind of give him a look like, what the fuck, man? But it was great. And but to tell you that story, I got another point to this story. So this is before Fuji passed away. Mm-hmm. So they have a bunch of pictures. And he goes, well, which one do you want? I like all of them. And I'm like, honestly, sir, I'm not sure. I was like, which one's your favorite? I'll let you pick. He goes, well, I like these two. And it was one of Demolition and Fuji, and it was one of Demolition and Crush. And he said, you could get this one. And he points it to one of Fuji. He goes, you might be able to get him to sign it if he's ever at a convention you're at. Then he points it to one of Crush. He goes, you can get this one. I don't think he's going to sign it anytime soon. holy shit.
Oh, good Lord.
I just broke. I was like, give me the Fuji one. I can't take it. Give me the Fuji one.
Oh, man. Oh, that's funny. I never knew that, but Bill Eadie, he's actually from Western Pennsylvania where I'm at. He went to Uniontown and stuff. So about, like, I don't know, about 35 minutes or 40 minutes down the road from me. But that's great.
I could be here all day telling these funny stories, but I've met so many great people in wrestling. You know, I could be here for days talking about more Boogie stories and fucking Ricky Morton stories and shit like that. I mean, some of the characters you've gotten in wrestling. All right, okay, damn it. I'll forget this one. I got one more. This is my last wrestling story for this show.
Right.
I'm sure it's just a joke that he heard somewhere. Ricky Morton is one of those guys where, just to make the stories better, he'll claim he was around for this story. So, this is a joke that I'm sure is old as the hills that Ricky Morton told me. Ricky Morton did a couple tours in Japan. He did a couple shows in FMW and stuff. So, you know, he was around a bunch of guys. And he said that one of the guys he went on a tour with in Japan, he fucked a rat, a Japanese rat. So, he said they get back to America and he's on a show with him. Like a couple weekends after they got back from Japan, he goes, "Ricky, man, you gotta look at this." He goes, "What?" And he pulls his dick out. And Ricky goes, "God damn, son, your dick's fucking black, blue, red, purple, and plaid." He goes, "I know, what the fuck do I do?" He goes, "Go see a fucking doctor, what's wrong with you?" So, Ricky sees him again. And he goes, "Ricky, I went to a doctor." He said, "What did the doctor say?" He said, "God damn, son, your dick's black, blue, red, purple, and plaid." He goes, "I know, what do I do?" He said, I don't know, dude. He said, "Go see a fucking Japanese doctor. The only thing I have to tell you is I'm going to cut it off." He says, don't cut my dick off. No. So Ricky said, "Well, damn, son, you better go see a Japanese doctor." So Ricky said he saw him the next month. He said, "Hey, man, did you ever get anything taken care of?" He goes, "Man, I went all the way to Japan and saw a doctor." He said, "Really? What did the doctor say?" He goes, "Oh, goddamn, dick, blue, black, red, purple, plaid." He goes, "No shit. What the fuck do I do?" He goes, I not do anything for you. You go see an American doctor." He said, "I went and saw an American doctor. He said he had to cut my dick off." He goes, "Oh, no, no cut dick off." He goes, "Oh, really?" He goes, "No, dick fall off in 2 months." So that's a typical Ricky Morton joke for everybody. Sorry.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll get some hate mail for that one, but whatever.
That was pretty good. Yeah. I almost don't want to talk no more.
You should want to end it on that one?
We just might as well just end it on that one.
All right.
Oh, fuck. That was great.
Maybe one day I can catch Ricky and pull him aside for a podcast, because these jokes are so much better coming from him, but they're the best.
I can't imagine. I cannot imagine. So, well, we're at we're over the 2 hour mark. So, we'll wind her down. Gary will be back, probably, unless the Penguins win or don't win, then he won't be back for next episode.
Right. Yeah. The next time we're recording could possibly be on Game 7 if one's needed. So.
Well, it's nothing in the third period with 5 left to go, so.
Holy shit, really? Damn.
Yeah. So. Well, we got a lot more, you know, positive feedback from the last episode. And traffic's been really well on the site and everything, so. Again, just hit us up on our Ringside Chat Facebook or on Twitter at Ringside Pod. Look for myself, Gary, and Court on there, and you know, just add the people on there. Go to Podbeam and check us out there. So, Court, what you got going on coming up?
Well, by the time this comes out, I've got 2 shows coming up on this weekend. I will be in Concord, North Carolina, at a promotion called CCW. You can see, we'll be wrestling The Power. We as in me and my tag team partner, Kyle Miller, The Chaos Connection. Then on that Sunday, we'll be in Pelham, North Carolina for Pure Pro Wrestling, wrestling The Power again. But this time, we'll be defending our Pure Pro Wrestling Tag Team titles. You can see all that. Go on my Facebook. It's facebook.com/Court Montgomery Wrestling. I always try to keep up all my dates and stuff. Find me on Twitter or Instagram at CMDangerous. I'm always posting shit. Just, you know, I've got merch for sale, as always. T-shirts, magnets, coffee mugs. You want it, I got it. If you want something and my face is not on it, I would gladly put my face on it. I need that money. I got to talk to Sonny.
That's it. Got to make that chatter. Yeah, so check that all out. I know Gary's got some articles up on PW Pondering, so give him a look. He's got one on the Wing promotion, and I'm sure he's got a few other things in the works. I think he's planning on doing one for the IWC Super Indie show that Adam Cole's at and won the title there. So
yeah, this would have been a 3-person podcast. We had planned on recording last night, but he had front row tickets to the Super Indie, so not gonna hate on him for that. You know, he said it was a great show, and he talked about possibly doing a review of that on maybe one of the podcasts, or maybe just doing an article. So I'm excited to hear from that. I hope he hurries that and puts out part two of his Wing article, because part one was awesome.
Yeah, it was really, really well done. He's got he's a pretty good writer. And I think that's really about it. So yeah, like I said, check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and then our Podbean. We will always post about what's going on for future episodes and when the next episode is going to be out. Also, too, just, you know, check Court out and everything like that. So, all right, guys, so that wraps it up for tonight. So, I'm out.
We'll see you next time, guys.